Americans in the Age Revolution. Suzanne Brown Levine, Mark Friedman, James Hollis, and Abigail Trafford.
I mean, you get to the point where you say, if not now, when?
That's 2 p.m. this Tuesday on Good for Life, where experience talks.
Good afternoon, I'm Patrick Burke, here with an update from the KPFK newsroom. The time is 3 o'clock. Bombings killed 5 Iraqi policemen and a U.S. soldier today in Baghdad. In Ramadi, residents describe retaliatory violence between nationalist anti-occupation rebels and al-Qaeda members. The alleged falling out is being attributed to a massacre of police recruits earlier this month blamed on Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's group. Saddam Hussein is due to return to court tomorrow, although his defense team says they will seek a halt of proceedings. The court named a new chief judge today after the original presiding judge resigned and his replacement was accused of being a supporter of the former Iraqi president. Augusto Pinochet's wife and 4 children are in custody. The former Chilean dictator's family members were arrested today on tax evasion and fraud charges as part of an investigation into secret multimillion-dollar bank accounts. The judge in the case says the arrests were justified by maliciously incomplete and false tax declarations. Attorney General Bill Lockyer is announcing a $325 million settlement with Orange-based mortgage company AmeriQuest. The deal resolves allegations that AmeriQuest, the nation's largest lender catering to home buyers unable to qualify for traditional bank loans, deceived borrowers, falsified loan documents, and pressured appraisers to overstate home values. Of the $325 million, $295 million will go toward restitution for customers and $30 million to states involved in the investigation. Powerful winds are fanning flames in several parts of the Southland, with at least one home in Tujunga destroyed and at least 3 others damaged. The National Weather Service has issued a red flag warning of extreme fire danger due to the high winds and low humidity. LA County Fire Department spokespeople say the high wind warnings will be in effect until 3 p.m. tomorrow. Power outages have also affected at least 75,000 Southland customers. We'll have more on these and several other stories on the evening newscast at 6 o'clock and another update at 4. Stay tuned now for Indie Media On Air.
All right, welcome to Indie Media On Air. I'm Chris Burnett, and that was Corner Soul by The Clash. Today we have a very special show for you. We're going to be talking with Brandon Darby from Common Ground Collective in New Orleans and Emily, who is a volunteer with Common Ground, who's from Los Angeles. Before that, we're going to have some headlines, and then in the latter half of the hour, we'll be joined by the people who do that with more sarcastic sarcasm. All right. World Social Forum 2006 opens in Bamako, Mali. World Social Forum is an alternative to the World Economic Forum, a yearly meeting of business and political elites in Davos, Switzerland. Believing that, quote, another world is possible, the World Social Forum is a space for exchanging information and experiences in the struggle against neoliberal policies and corporate globalization efforts. The past decade has seen a wide range of popular resistance in Africa, and this year's forum will offer an opportunity for dialogue and reflection on recent struggles and the alternatives they offer in the global project to build a better world based on solidarity and common struggle, not competition and war. This year's World Social Forum is being held simultaneously in Bamako, Mali, Caracas, Venezuela, and Karachi, Pakistan. The Bamako World Social Forum opened on the 19th. Approximately 30,000 activists from across the region and the world are expected to attend. This is the first World Social Forum to be held in Africa. Some of the themes of the WSF include militarization and war, outcomes of the Hong Kong WTO meeting, UN Reform and Migration. In order to cover the events at the WSF, Indie Media and other media activists have set up an independent media center as part of the Thomas Sankara Youth Camp. Coverage in English will be carried on at the IMC in South Africa and in French at IMC Marseille. Photos and audio from the youth camp are also available. For more information, please visit indiemedia.org. From indiemedia.us, last Thursday, January 15, 2006, over 100 UCSD and UCLA students staged a die-in at the UCSD Price Center, a central area for campus traffic, to urge the UC Regents to divest from Darfur. The UC Regents met to decide on whether or not to divest. Race-based genocide is going on in Darfur, and over 400,000 have died as a result. As students and a TV crew looked on, the students held signs about divestment, and numerous people spoke about why they were holding the die-in. During the meeting, the Regents voted yes to create a committee to consider divestment. For more information on this story, please visit indiemedia.us and UCDivestSudan.com. That's UCDivestSudan.com. From indiemedia.us, Philly IMC coverage from fact-finding tour of the South. On January 10, 2006, members of the Philly IMC have joined the Poverty Initiative on a fact-finding tour of the South. The group, which also includes 40 Columbia Social Work and Union Seminary students, is meeting with community groups, evacuees, and politicians in five cities to document firsthand the struggle against poverty that Katrina has brought to the nation's attention. The U.S. is the richest nation in the history of the world, yet 45 million have no health insurance, soup kitchen visits are up 150%, and child homelessness is at an all-time high. Philly IMC is highlighting the grassroots efforts that offer real solutions to poverty in this country. And from their website, which is phillyimc.org, you can find a seven-day fact-finding mission reports. So they have day 1 through 7 reporting on what they found. They have Katrina evacuees pitted against Atlanta's poor. They have podcasts from Free Radio Georgia and a number of interviews. So please, for more information on the story, visit phillyimc.org, and we'll be right back.
In every house on earth, road. But don't go alone now, the wind has blown away the colors.
All right, today we're going to have a special discussion with members of Common Ground Collective, who are based in New Orleans, and talk about some of their work. I want to give out the website first, so you can check it out while we have this discussion. It's commongroundrelief.org, commongroundrelief.org. And we'll be speaking with Brandon Darvey from Common Grounds and Emily, a volunteer from Los Angeles, who was there in October. The Common Ground Collective was established in the first week after Hurricane Katrina flooded New Orleans. It was the first organization to open up a medical clinic, provide immediate assistance, food, water, supplies to the thousands of low-income residents unable to evacuate. The recent hurricanes not only devastated much of the city of New Orleans, they exposed long-standing injustices faced by the residents of the lower-income African-American communities. It is estimated that over 275,000 housing units were destroyed, and efforts to clean up, repair, or open livable housing has been slow. In New Orleans Parish, nearly 40% of the community earns $20,000 per year, and more than 70% of the households are headed by a single parent. Literacy rates in New Orleans is roughly 39%. It is critical, therefore, that immediate needs of the community are being met while long-term strategies to stabilize the community are initiated. Common Ground's mission is to provide short-term relief for victims of hurricane disasters in the Gulf Coast region and long-term support in rebuilding the communities affected in the New Orleans area. And to join us today, I'd like to welcome Brandon Darvey. Welcome to Indie Media on Air.
Thank you.
And Emily from Los Angeles, are you with us?
Yes.
Welcome. Well, Brandon, let's start with you. Why don't you give us an update on what's happening on the ground in New Orleans and what Common Ground is doing?
Well, there's a lot happening on the ground in New Orleans. Something important to mention is that there's always been a lot happening on the ground, especially in terms of neglect and of need. Like many other places in this country and around the world,
Brandon, can you speak up a little bit? We're having a hard time hearing you.
Excuse me. Can you hear me better now?
Yeah.
In particular, in New Orleans, in Louisiana, we've had, like you had addressed some of the issues, from the times of slavery, people in New Orleans have been neglected and have been kept suppressed so that they could be servants to a hotel industry and a casino industry, among many other industries. So coming here after the storm and during the storm, right in the days right after the storm, and addressing the short-term needs like water, food, immediate home repair, that's one aspect of what Common Ground is still doing but and has done. But the other thing is we've established ourselves as a form of, we use our privilege, that is, to empower local groups and to provide protection for local groups that have been here and that have been working on social justice issues and working towards social justice for many years, some of them for many decades. And that's kind of where things are going in this at this time here with Common Ground, is we still have our distribution centers, and we have them all over southeast Louisiana. But we're also starting to provide support and provide legal support and personnel support to local groups that have been struggling for years.
And Emily, why don't you talk a little bit about what you did with Common Ground?
Well, I went down with the Veterans for Peace caravan in October, so my impressions of the work there are going to be a lot different than what's happening now. We were providing, at that time, providing immediate assistance. You know, people were having trouble finding places to get food, medical attention, that sort of thing. And we had just begun, Common Ground had just begun work in the Ninth Ward. The city of New Orleans had finally opened it up that the week that I was there, and so Common Ground had decided that it was time to branch out and set up shelters and distribution centers in the Ninth Ward. So when I was there, much of that area was completely empty of people. There was a few people returning to view their homes and survey the damage, and it was a really emotional time for the residents there who were kept out for, you know, close to 6 weeks before they could, and this is the upper ninth, not the lower ninth ward, which they were kept out, I believe, till December. So, you know, when I was working there, we were just trying to ascertain if people were going to stay in the ninth ward or if residents were either too frightened by the experiences they'd gone through post-Katrina and had too little resources to be able to stay. But those that were willing to stay, we were basically trying to make a presence there to show them that we're going to be there to help them. And I understand now that Common Ground has several distribution centers in the Ninth Ward and a medical center and many other things that Brandon could talk about the specifics about.
Well, I've heard a lot of reports that the city is trying to bulldoze a lot of the houses, and that there's been efforts on part of people to go in at night and actually stay in some of the structures that seem to be stable, and either mark them somehow or prevent the city from bulldozing them, and that there was a small, well, not, I guess it would be called a victory, only in the sense that the victory was actually upholding established law. Brandon, can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, in particular, we're speaking of the Lower Ninth Ward right now.
Okay.
And we've just begun a project there in the Lower Ninth Ward. And that the Lower Ninth Ward is well below sea level. It's, a good portion of the community is completely destroyed. In particular, there's a third of the Lower Ninth Ward. There's roughly 14,000 homes in the Lower Ninth Ward. It represents 22,000 people. When the storm came, many of those people couldn't evacuate, so that's where many of the deaths have occurred. And since the storm, the military and the Homeland Security and the New Orleans Police Department have kept the area on a lockdown and shutdown, even though 2 miles away in St. Bernard Parish, which is just as low for the most part and is just as damaged for the most part, people have been allowed to return to their homes and return to their lots and have been allowed to make a decision on what they wanted done, go through and get their own personal belongings, have the debris cleared and the remains of what once was their home cleared, and then put a FEMA trailer on that property. And the state has done a lot to make sure they had power and sewer systems, sewer infrastructure.
What is a FEMA trailer? What do you mean by that?
FEMA trailer. Okay, I guess I get so caught up in being here then. FEMA trailers, it's the temporary housing that FEMA provides for victims of disasters whose homes have been destroyed. And it's a small white trailer that people are allowed to live in while their homes are rebuilt. But in the Lower Ninth Ward, though there's only a chain-link fence separating the Lower Ninth from St. Bernard Parish, residents have not been allowed to return. It was in December 21st or 22nd that residents were allowed for what was called sneak and peek, or peek and leave, where they could go into the community on buses, not get off the bus, look at their property, and not stay the night there. And that's when we realized the extent to which developers have had their eyes on this particular piece of property in the Lower Ninth Ward, this particular geographic area. And then we realized that the way that FEMA and the way that the city and the way that the state were distributing their aid and restricting aid was in favor of what developers wanted, which is to have that land and to keep people out of that area. That's when we decided to act on it. So what we did was we found a small home that was slated for bulldozing that was structurally okay. We talked with the homeowners, and we got a lease on the property. And the lease made it our private property for 3 months. And so we began to stay there. We went to the police department, went to FEMA officials, and we told them that we were going to be staying there. And they said they would arrest us if we stayed there. And we said, well, we believe it's unconstitutional. And we have a team of 40-some-odd attorneys that hope you arrest us for being there so we can put an end to this right away. And so they never arrested us, and then they lifted the curfew. And we've been staying there, passing out literature to tourists, which is sad to say, but many people do go there to look at the barge that's sitting in the neighborhood and to see the destruction, even though there are people returning for the first time to look at their damaged homes and to look for their loved ones that are still missing. Still 3,500 people are missing from the New Orleans area, but his bodies have not been recovered. But yet tourists come, and so we give information to them. We educate them on what happened and the neglect that these people went through historically and in light of a natural disaster and a man-made disaster, which was the levees breaking. And we try to inspire and offer hope to the residents to return so that there's something going on there, and it's not just dark at night with federal agents patrolling the street. So we light the place up with a generator. We have flowers planted. And we also use the space for the community to have meetings, which they have twice a week. So we end up with 40 to 50 Lower Ninth Ward residents, and they're starting to organize themselves, and we're there in solidarity, and we're there to offer our privilege, since most of us are white activists from around the country, predominantly white activists from around the country, because we can afford to drop what we're doing and come here. And we offer that privilege kind of on a model like the ISM, the International Solidarity Movement. We come and we offer that privilege as witnesses, and many times to physically step in front of bulldozers as they try to illegally bulldoze the homes of a predominantly African-American community.
What is the state's rationale for the what appears to be a very unequal treatment between the Ninth Ward and the community next door to it?
Well, it depends when you say the state.
FEMA or the police department.
Or the state of Louisiana, yeah. They say that the area was crime-ridden, that the people that live there really don't want to come back, or they would be back already, which clearly isn't true. To preface this, what happened with these people, a year before the storm came, before Katrina, there was a storm called Hurricane Ivan. And it was coming towards the city of New Orleans. 80% of the city got evacuated. The other 20% were left to die. There was no plan for them. The storm missed at the last moment and hit Alabama and Florida, some parts of Mississippi. And afterwards, it exposed a great injustice was almost propagated against these people. So the federal government gave Ray Nagin the mayor of New Orleans, $17 million to come up with an evacuation plan. Well, 1 year later, a large storm comes towards New Orleans. 80% of the population was evacuated, and the other 20% were left to die without any evacuation plan, though they had known, they knew what would happen if that storm hit the city. So those people that were left to die, many of them in the lower Ninth Ward, they were left on the rooftops for a week. When young men from the community began to try to organize and go around and help people, help their community, they were shot at and killed, called looters. And then the people that finally did get evacuated were left at the convention center and the Superdome in their own feces and in their own urine for days without water or food, though others, like Harry Connick Jr., was able to drive up to the Superdome and give out water to people. The government somehow couldn't manage to get there and help people with water or food or any type of facilities to aid them and help them. Many of those people tried to walk across a several-mile-long bridge that goes across the Mississippi River to dry apart, and they were shot at by white racist police officers and sheriff deputies from Gretna, which is a small town near New Orleans, predominantly white flight community, that people were, where it's populated by people who had left New Orleans in the 60s when black Americans began to gain civil rights. And they were shot at, and they were turned back, and they had to sit in this filth. And then buses finally showed up, and they told these people, get on the damn bus. Shut up. Get on the bus. And they're like, well, my mom's over there. Shut up. Get on the damn bus. And that's how people were treated. And they were stuck on buses and shipped all across the country, some as far away as Alaska, many in California, all over the country. They were prevented from coming home, and then they're going to use the excuse that the people obviously don't want to come home so we can take their area and we don't need to have services to that area. When clearly, you know, if you knew the history of the Lower Ninth Ward, you knew that it had the highest rate of black home ownership in the country, you know, and you realize that many of the homes there had been owned by family units for generations.
And the statistic that I have heard is 67% was the population of New Orleans was African American, and now it's down to 40%.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. So the people of the Lower Ninth Ward and the city in general want to come home because that's all they've ever had. That's all they were ever allowed to have was that area. And each street was populated by a mother, and the next house over was the grandmother, and the next house over was the daughter and her husband, and the next house over. Each street, most of the streets, had entire family units, you know, living on these streets. And to say that this is the excuse that the government uses, is that they don't want to come home or they'd be home already.
I want to remind listeners that I'm speaking with Brandon Darby from Common Ground Collective in New Orleans and Emily from Los Angeles, a volunteer who went to New Orleans in October and is planning to go back this spring. And the website for people who want to take a look at this and perhaps get involved with Common Ground is commongroundrelief.org, commongroundrelief.org. And your website's very informative, and I was just so impressed with some of the programs that you're working on, from free medical clinic, emergency repair, legal support, housing advocacy, communications, cleanup, a women's center that just opened, environmental monitoring, and a community ground, a Common Ground Kids and Community Project. It sounds like just very important work that you all are doing on the ground there. And Emily, if you you plan to go back in the spring, is there anything specifically that you plan to focus on?
Well, because I haven't been down there in some time, I'll probably spend some time just sitting in as I can. I'm definitely interested in starting a grassroots evacuation plan for people. So the people that are living in the Ninth Ward now and plan to do so during hurricane season next year, that there's something in place for people that may not have vehicles or have the money to provide for hotels and, you know, the time that they'd have to spend away from home. So that's a big priority for me to begin work on that. And I would like to say, too, that when I go down, I'm hoping to plan a...
Emily, can you speak up just a little bit?
Yeah, I'm hoping to plan a road trip. So, you know, have a few cars come with me on my way down there. And if people are interested in volunteering down there at any point, I'm happy to give my number out if they want to talk to me personally about that.
Why don't you go ahead and do that?
Okay, my number is 213-447-4217. It's 213-447-4217.
And why don't we go ahead and open up the phones, because I think this is an important discussion to have, and have people call in if they have any specific questions about what they might want to do if they want to come to New Orleans and get involved and help on the project. The number is 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-5735. You're listening to KPFK Los Angeles 90.7 FM and in Santa Barbara at 98.7 FM and on the internet at www.kpfk.org. Brandon, what other your website lists some future projects that you plan to get involved with. Maybe you can talk a little bit about those. And how many people locally in the communities are getting involved in some of the activities that that Common Ground is working on? What kind of relationship is there between the people directly affected by this tragedy and your organization?
I'll address that first. I'll address the issue of the question of what kind of involvement are we having from the community and what kind of relationships do we hold with the community. Naturally, I mean, many of us on a personal level have developed very close relationships with many people in the community. But as a whole, I think that the community feels empowered by having the resources here and by having folks with organizing skills and folks with media connections and what have you here. Many of the things we were doing, like in the Ninth Ward, initially there wasn't a lot of involvement from the community because there wasn't many people from the community back. You know, we were addressing the needs of elderly residents that did not leave, and then it turned into addressing the needs of young couples and young people that wanted to return, and making sure their homes were gutted and the mold remediation was done, and making sure that their roofs were tarped so that they weren't rained on and there wasn't further damage to the house. Because even though most of the city that's predominantly white, or half of the city that's predominantly white, received help from FEMA as far as getting roofs tarped, most of the black communities in New Orleans did not receive any help getting their roofs tarped. So we began to do that, and we began to address the needs that people had. Over time, it's turning into a situation on the Upper Ninth Ward where residents are beginning, and churches in particular, are beginning to follow the model, something similar to the model that we've set up. Of course, they're adjusting it as needed and use the resources that we have and the knowledge we've gained about massive outdoor kitchens that can feed many people, sleeping arrangements, decontamination areas for the equipment that you're using in moldy houses and what have you. And we're starting to see community members take over the role of Common Ground in their community, which is very encouraging. And many of them do not call themselves Common Ground, but they're supported, and we are definitely in solidarity with them and share with them anything, any resources, any human resources, whatever they need. So that's been very encouraging. And that's predominantly happening in most of the downtown area, which represents about 225,000 people's homes, not all of which are back, some of which are back. That's been very encouraging to us, and to have that kind of involvement from the community. In the Lower Ninth Ward, it's a little bit different. We have less volunteers down there because there's a potential for arrest, and because there is so much. Risk down there with not only health concerns, but also, with federal agents and what have you. We have to really limit the number of folks down there. But the tools and everything that we have down there are being used by the community members to gut their own homes and to take care of their own issues and to follow some of the models we've set forward and also to initiate other models that we didn't think of. So community involvement is growing daily.
Brandon, I want to take a quick question from Cecil from Studio City we have on the line. Cecil, welcome to Indie Media on Air. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I was personally disturbed by what Mayor Nagin said when he invoked God in his comments the other day, and I just wondered what your guest thought about that. If he thought it was appropriate for him to presume to speak for God about the New Orleans situation. Thank you.
Okay, is that a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, how to say this the best way possible. What that man and the city in general and the state and the federal government says about any issue changes day to day, and they consistently make asinine remarks that do not represent the people they are supposed to be serving. So before getting too far off into that particular comment or the last particular plan that they've released for the 9th Ward or for the 7th Ward or for any of the other homes of 225,000 black residents that are being neglected, I'll say this. I think it's definitely what the model we're using down here. And I think it's time we begin to use this model across the country, where we quit focusing on what these corrupt and inhumane individuals are saying, and we just begin to build our own society and do things the way that we think they should be done, and come together, come up with the resources to do this, put our heads together, and go about our business as far as creating socially just systems for people to live with. So in regards to what he said, he makes comments, Mayor Nagin makes comments every week that they don't get as much media attention as his most recent comments about it being an all-chocolate city and God wanting it to be a chocolate city or an African-American city. Regardless of someone's views on God, there is nothing godly about anything that man has done or the businesses that dictate his policies have done. And that goes all the way up to the federal level. There is nothing godly about what the state has done here, and there is nothing godly about what the federal government has done here, not only in this situation, but in many situations that are occurring day to day on this planet. So I think it's rather than get too far off into his comments, I think it's important that we just worry about and focus on the work that needs to be done to create social justice and socially just systems.
This is a question for both of you, and I wanted to ask you, what would you tell people now who are thinking and, you know, considering coming down to New Orleans to help out? What would be your message to them?
You want to go for that, Emily?
Go ahead, Brennan.
Emily?
Emily, why don't we go ahead and if you can address that question, what would you tell people?
That's a pretty big question. I mean, if somebody feels like they feel within themselves a need to go down there and work, I would encourage them as much as possible just to approach it with to approach the volunteering there and the working down there with humility and with respect and just a lot of listening to people who are from there.
You could speak up just a little bit, sorry.
A lot of listening to people who are from there, and a lot of it's the first, you know, if you have a chance to go down there, I would recommend spending as much time as possible, because when I was there, I spent only 2 weeks, and I felt like only towards the end was I finally able to understand even a little bit sort of the political character of the area and the historical significance of everything that had happened up until that point, and to be able to approach it with any kind of sense of what was really going on. But if people can devote a couple weeks, a month, and any sort of skill or unskilled person is needed, as far as I can tell, as long as there's a, you know, as long as you've got a sort of stick-to-itiveness and a willingness to work, there's a lot to be done. So.
And Brandon, what would you say?
Well, first off, I couldn't hear what Emily said, the phone was. The way it came across, I couldn't hear the words.
She was just basically saying to have some humility and listen to people and go down there with an open heart, I think.
Yes, I would agree with that. One of the things that we're trying to encourage is that people attend deconstructing racism and dismantling racism training, so they make sure that when they do come down here, if they are white, that they're not coming down here propagating a white supremacist model of thought, and that they're not pushing their culture on the community here, because the community here definitely has, I mean, to say the communities here definitely have their own cultures, and it's very important that those cultures are preserved and that we're sensitive and not isolating to those cultures. However, as far as coming down, we are in a situation right now, especially in the Lower Ninth Ward, where the Lower Ninth Ward residents are about to have their homes bulldozed against their will. Most of the Lower Ninth Ward residents around the country do not realize this because there's no way to communicate with them. So the residents that are here, roughly 275 to 300 residents, are they're organizing checkpoints to make sure that bulldozers and dump trucks don't come into their community without permission from a homeowner. And they're really concerned about how the government is going to treat them for taking matters into their own hands and standing up for their communities in face of the government neglecting them and allowing developers to have their way with their land. So coming down, it's extremely important that there are warm bodies to be witnesses and to provide protection for the residents as they stand up for their land. So I would say, please come down, whether you want to come down with Common Ground or whether you want to come down as an autonomous group, and Common Ground can assist you with material aid, with maybe financial aid, and with knowledge on how to function in this area, and help you to meet people. We're also very encouraging of autonomous groups coming down. It's very important that there are human beings here to witness what is happening in this area. Because what is happening is that unjust. It is that wrong. The watching the way that aid is distributed and the way that the military and federal agents are treating these residents. So please come down. If you have the resources to come, one good thing to do being that because of privilege and because of economic and white privilege, many of the volunteers that come down are white. One thing that might be good to do is to speak with groups in your own communities and try to find out if your resources can be better used, allowing young people of color to come down in place of you. That's also an option.
All right, Brandon, listen, we have to wrap up because we're almost out of time here on this segment, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Indie Media on Air. And Emily, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
I want to give out the information real quick one more time. It's commongroundrelief.org. And Emily, if you don't mind, please give out your phone number one more time.
Yeah, that's 213-447-4217. Call me if you have any questions regarding volunteering and you're from L.A. or interested in going down to New Orleans.
Great. Thank you very much, both of you.
You're listening to Indie Media on the Air here on your independent radio station, KPFK Los Angeles, Pacifica Radio for the World. Stay tuned at 4 to hear the voices from the frontline edition of the 4 o'clock report. Stay with us.
All right, we're back. This is Indie Media on Air. I'm Chris Burnett, and we are switching gears a little bit to move into the People Who Do That territory, and I'm joined in studio by Derek. What's up, Derek?
How you doing, Chris? Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So what's going on?
Well, we've got some national corporate radio news for today's broadcast, which for those unfamiliar is a parody of National Public Radio, and we bring the news to you. And I noted at the top of the show, you mentioned that we brought sarcastic sarcasm. I just wanted to let you know that's actually kind of passé now. We've moved on to sincere sarcasm.
Oh, sorry.
If I'd only known.
Yeah. Well. They both start with S's, and I was getting confused or something.
That's okay. It's a new press release.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't get the memo.
Oh, it's you're not on the list. Oh, my bad. My bad.
Okay. Well, why don't we hear some sincere sarcasm then? How do we go about doing that?
Well,
what are we going to hear?
We're going to hear Bush's latest press conference, which has been edited for clarity. So it's edited now to say what he really means. We're going to hear a little bit about the Abramoff scandal, which you may not know a lot about, but we've got the scoop.
Okay, excellent. All right, let's go.
This is NCR, National Corporate Radio News. Our news for you.
President Bush is personally listening to your telephone conversations and kindly asks that you dumb it down a little.
We take a look at Bill O'Reilly's new book, Who's Looking Out for Your Falafel?
And Donald Rumsfeld has started ignoring his own questions.
Those stories and more coming up on All Things Condescended.
First, this news.
From NCR News in Washington, I'm Craig Winded. Osama bin Laden released a new tape today. It is a workout tape designed to keep jihadists fit and toned for the big day. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said the White House would only take the tape seriously if it were available on DVD. Officials from the Federal Mine Health and Safety Organization are in West Virginia today, investigating ways to make the Sago and other mines there safer. The officials started to improve mine safety this morning by lobbing bombs into a coal mine to set it on fire. As miners trapped below were incinerated to death, it remained unclear as to how this new policy improved safety, but it did produce awesome-looking explosions for many evening news broadcasts. The Justice Department issued subpoenas in federal court this morning for the Bush administration, charging it with eco-terrorism. In a legal document over 6,000 pages long, Justice Department lawyers cited numerous examples of how the Bush administration had wreaked more terror on the environment than Osama bin Laden could ever hope to do on human beings. It was at this point in the dream that I woke up and remembered that if we stop driving SUVs, the eco-terrorists win. Iran has resumed its uranium enrichment program to the dismay of U.S. government and IAEA inspectors. Iran claims it is not enriching uranium to make weapons, but instead for civilian power projects, such as the vast People's Ruin for the Infidels machine and the Zionist incinerator. The Defense Department responded with a statement saying that the U.S. has no plans to invade Iran, because it already has. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is up 78 points on news of a weak job market and the general suffering of the poor. The blood of Chinese laborers sent the NASDAQ up too, while the S&P, still hungry for its pound of flesh, is pouting in the corner. This is NCR News.
From NCR News, this is All Things Condescended. I'm No Angel.
And I'm Ambazo. President Bush held a press conference today to address a wide range of topics, from abuse of executive power to abuse of prisoners to abuse of the English language. Let's listen now to a few excerpts from that press conference.
I'd be glad to answer some questions here, starting with you, Terry.
Mr. President, what achievements do you look forward to in the new year?
I hope tyranny continues to take root around the world. I want New Orleans and Mississippi to see decades of bitterness. And I hope people get booted out of housing. And we have every reason to be optimistic about our future. Let's see here. Sanger.
Mr. President, you say that invading Iraq was the right thing to do, but don't you feel that maybe you weren't too honest with the American public about Iraq's capacity to harm us with weapons of mass destruction?
Sanger, I hate to admit it, but it was a mistake to go into Iraq. I can't think of anything more dispiriting than what we're seeing in Iraq. No question. My only point to you is there's a lot of work to get rid of the past. Yet we're headed in the right direction, and it's an exciting moment in history. Stretch.
Oh, thank you, Mr. President, for taking my question. I really wanted to ask you, since the war on terror is scheduled to go on forever, is there any chance at all that you could stay president forever?
I think that there is an opportunity to amend the Constitution, and I'm very optimistic about the way forward for the assertion of unchecked power. Wendell.
Mr. President, some people have taken the federal government's indifference to the devastation caused by Hurricane Katrina as a sign that you don't care about black people. Why don't you set the record straight and tell us how you really feel about African Americans?
No, I appreciate that. First, you got to understand, and I hope the American people understand, African Americans are very dangerous. And this is an enemy which is quick and it's lethal. I hope you can feel my passion about killing African Americans. You know, people, I hear people say, you know, we stirred them up. They're dangerous. No, they were dangerous before we went into New Orleans. Thank you. Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. President. I was just wondering, how much longer do you think you can stay in office before you're impeached?
I think a brief period of time, relatively brief. Adam.
Excuse me, thank you. Yes, Mr. President. Are you really as dumb as you look?
I think people believe that. I know this. People know that. That's universally accepted. Let's see here. Martha.
Well, thank you, sir. It's now come out on national corporate radio that you intend to round up so-called subversives and take them to, I believe you call them, re-education rodeos, sponsored by Clear Channel, at large stadiums across the nation. Where do you derive the legal authority to do this?
It's an executive order.
Okay.
In this case, not monitored by the Congress, nor is there any administrative oversight. I want to make clear to the people listening that this legal authority is derived from foreign sources of oil and a group of thugs and killers. That's what the American people want. But I'm telling you, I am doing what you expect me to do. And beyond that, I think that's all I'm going to say. But I appreciate it. April.
Mr. President, it is often said that you don't like to read very much, but lately you've been seen on several occasions with children's puzzle books. How's that going for you, and do you have any trouble connecting the dots?
April, the answer is absolutely. You might remember, if you take a step back, people were wondering how come the dots weren't connected. It is inexcusable to say, on the one hand, connect the dots and not give us a chance to do so. We've connected the dots. Are trying to connect the dots with the Shameful Act program. But we're connecting dots as best as we possibly can. That's positive. Joe.
Thank you, Mr. President. Vice President Cheney's Chief of Staff, Louis Lyer Libby's trial is going to begin soon on charges of perjury and obstruction of justice. What outcome would you like to see come out of that trial?
He didn't deserve a trial. You know, he deserves immediate death for what he did to my people. John.
Mr. President, oh gosh, thanks so much for taking my question. God, I was just wondering, what's your favorite Billy D. Williams movie?
Let's see. Jackson, Action Jackson. Thank you all for coming.
Mr. President, would it be okay if I let you finish?
Let me finish.
Could I please let you finish?
Let me start with...
I'd like to let you finish.
Hold a second, please. Sorry, I gave a long answer.
Would it be okay if I finish first?
Yeah, you see,
excuse me, Mr. President.
No, I appreciate that. Who have I not called on? Let's see here.
Mr. President, I'm just about to finish.
Let me finish. Forgot what got me on the subject, but nevertheless, I'm okay. We're doing the right thing. Thank you all for coming. Appreciate it.
That was President Bush desperately clinging to power and brandishing it like a hockey stick at the same time. It has the potential to be a bigger scandal than Watergate and even sexier than Monica Lewinsky, though that really isn't much of a challenge. We're talking about the Abramoff scandal, of course, and how the best little lobbying house this side of Texas proved to be a temptation too sweet for a horde of D.C. lawmakers to resist. So who got caught with their hands in the naughty cookie jar? NCR's Peter Overlord is prepared to dish.
Washington, D.C. is in the throes of the Abramoff scandal, and now one congressman after another is denying having relations with that woman. By that woman, of course, they mean Ms. Jackie Abramoff. Until she decided to turn herself in this week, Jackie Abramoff was a K Street lobbyist, which is D.C. lingo for high-priced prostitute or money-minded juicy harlot intercourse toy, if you will. I know I will, or I would, but I work in public broadcasting, so I can't afford that. But few on Capitol Hill had the power to resist this gorgeous madam's allure. This Heidi Fleiss of the Hill decided to make her little black book a matter of public record, and horny Republicans who love to score with this tasty morsel are scurrying to deny they ever met a sweet asset named Jackie Abramoff. But denying it won't quite be so easy, because not only can Miss Abramoff name names, she can also produce receipts. Here's Wacky Jackie.
I feel really dirty about it, and that's why I decided to come clean. I gave members of Congress sex, or the sex, as some like to call it. And in exchange, they gave me legislation, or the bills, if you like. And I also billed them. And since I take Visa, I've got a pretty solid list of names here. Would you like to take a look? I know you like to look, Daddy.
You're hot, okay? But I got nothing for you.
What? Are you gay or something?
No, I'm married. And you're in federal prison, so cool your jets, princess. Jack Abramoff got around, big time. The list in her little black book is long and strong, and it's bound to get some friction on. Abramoff claims to have had lobbying relations, by which we do mean the sex, with more than 60 members of Congress, and that was just one three-day weekend on a casino boat in Miami. She also claims to have joined the Mile High Club with former Majority Leader and Bug Spray Man Tom DeLay on a flight to Scotland, ostensibly a golfing trip. Yes, that is what they're calling it these days, golfing. For his part, predictably, Tom DeLay is denying everything. Here's Congressman DeLay, soon to be doing hammer time in a white-collar prison.
I did not have relations with that lobbyist. Now, I freely admit I did pass legislation written for me by that hot, sweet, nasty Jezebel of my filthy dreams. That part is true. But I did deny her my essence.
And it wasn't just Republicans. It wasn't even just women. At this point, these are merely scurrilous accusations, and NCR certainly doesn't want to name names when it's only hearsay and rumor. But it's worth noting that I'm looking at these girl-on-girl pictures of Abramoff and Olympia Snow, and it's pretty hot stuff. Despite the obvious negative fallout expected from this scandal, experts we've been ordered to talk to told us to believe other things. For example, political sexpert Mara Rightwing thinks this is just another partisan attack by the Democrats.
I mean, my God, it's not like anyone got hurt here. This is just about sex. So what? The only person these members of Congress need to answer to about this is their spouses. It's just none of our business.
But isn't that exactly what the Democrats said when Republicans went after Bill Clinton for his extramarital affair?
Just because the facts are on your side doesn't mean you're right, you liberal scum. Do you want me to call Patricia Harrison and have her give you the bias test?
No, of course I don't. While it's hard to say just how far into the citadel of power the Abramoff whoring scandal will reach, it seems obvious now that it won't really matter as long as Republicans continue to control everything in Washington, including public broadcasting, and hence my job. Peter Overlord, NCR News, Suckupville.
President Bush tells Condoleezza Rice, "I'd like to wiretap that ass." Later on All Things Condescended.
The new Ang Lee film, Brokeback Mountain, has the mainstream media falling in love. Gay love. But what about the other voice of America that is constantly ignored and unheard? The voice of the patriotic conservative. Here now, for a different perspective, is NCR's very own white knight of the far right, Russell Smithen.
I just had the unbearably awful experience of witnessing that foul blight on our cultural landscape, Brokeback Mountain. Or should I say, Bareback Mounting. Get it? I made that one up, but feel free to use it. Anyways, folks, sodomy is a sin. Unless, of course, you're talking about a $2 hooker in the Philippines, and then it's any man's game. I just thank God there were some boobies in that movie, or I would have just lost my lunch. Now first, let me point out, the only reason I was even in that damn theater was because my wife Leanne tricked me into seeing it. When you tell me I'm going to see a Western, I expect to see men killing each other like the good Lord intended. Not hugging each other like a bunch of vegetarians. To think for one minute that these two rigid, virile cowboys, perfect symbols of the great American spirit that crushed the Indians to death, might actually fall in love with each other is entirely unnatural, unwholesome, and just gay. Like a wine tasting. I'm supposed to believe someone as tough and ruggedly handsome as Heath Ledger falls in love? Love is for queers. I don't mean love is for queers. Love is for women. But not women for other women. Unless it's one of those all-girl-on-girl action scenes like on the internet. Then it's okay. Anyway, making it seem as though two men could find true love together is an abomination in the face of all that is good and right in this world. It's like we're saying the terrorists won. Now, don't get me wrong. Men can experience great camaraderie and deep respect for each other's talents and abilities. Like on the sports field, the boardroom, or even the battlefield. Most men I know prefer the company of other men. For example, do you want to watch NASCAR with your buddies or your wife? Go out drinking with the boys or your woman? Practice wrestling moves with a man or a girl, I think you see my point. Because let's face it, man, most of the time, our wives and girlfriends and mistresses can be a real pain in the neck. The point is, men need to spend time with other men to truly express their masculinity, to appreciate the wonder of the well-toned male physique, and the smell of men enjoying themselves. These things aren't gay. These things are natural and life-affirming. And sometimes it's necessary for men in close proximity, denied the attention of their women folk, to help each other out a little bit. Like when you're in the Navy, or a good old-fashioned prison screw. But for God's sake, you do what you need to do, and you get it over with. You don't dance around in your underwear like you're Tom Cruise. I suppose I should mention that the old ball and chain, my wife Leanne, seemed to think this was somehow a good movie. Good, I says. Would she want our Russell Jr. to see this movie? No damn how, I says. It's bad enough he's on the figure skating team at school. You want him to go liberal? The boy's getting a subscription to Playboy, and I mean now. That'll straighten him out. Or worse still, do we want our fine young men overseas fighting the Iraqi horde to see this film? We might as well just surrender now. We need more decent movies where real men beat the living crap out of each other. Like The Passion of the Christ. And I'll tell you this, the Christ wouldn't ever diddle Jake Gyllenhaal. Unless he had no other choice. But he sure wouldn't have liked it. And he at least would have had the decency to kill him afterwards. God bless America. For NCR News, I'm Russell Smithen.
Russell Smithen is a retired naval drill commander, former prison guard, and ex-high school wrestling coach. He lives with his wife and son somewhere in one of those red states. He is not gay.
Support for NCR comes from Corn-tato. Corn-tato combines the goodness of corn with the convenience of potato. For more NCR, visit us on the web immediately at www.corntato.com. This is NCR, our news for you.
This is Indie Media on Air, and I am Chris Burnett, and we are out today. I want to thank Alan Minsky, our producer, and I want to thank Derek Iverson for coming in from The People Who Do That.
My pleasure.
And Brandon Darvey and from Common Ground Collective, and Emily, one of the volunteers with Common Ground. Thank you very much.
Listening to Indie Media on the Air on listener-supported radio KPFK Los Angeles, 90.7 FM and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. We are heard streaming globally at kpfk.org. The voices from the Frontline edition of the 4 o'clock report is coming up next. Stay tuned.
After 500 years of oppression, the indigenous people of Bolivia have succeeded in building a movement that kicked out U.S. multinational Bechtel Corporation out of their country when Bechtel tried to privatize their water. They have now succeeded in electing indigenous leader Evo Morales as president of Bolivia. President Morales has promised to be a nightmare for the Bush administration. Join us on Tuesday, January 24th on Sojourner Truth for a one-hour special on Bolivia. The election of Evo Morales, the relationship between Afro and indigenous communities in Bolivia, and more. Participants include indigenous leader, a senator in the new government,